Last time we were talking about the three ways in which sex increases genetic variation in offspring. Without looking, what are those three? Or any one of the three. Sexual reproduction, sexual species, increase the amount of genetic variation in their offspring, right? Asexual don't have genetic variation other than mutation. But sexual species do, and that genetic variation is increased or multiplied by three mechanisms that I talked about last time. I think I talked about them. Did I say the three? Yes. One of those is crossing over. That happens first. The second is independent assortment. So I did mention these, right? Because I did for certain sections and not for others. Okay, crossing over, independent assortment, and the third is random fertilization. Now, each of those by itself drastically increases the number of possible offspring, genetically different, is what I mean by possible. But they all happen in sexual reproduction, so they multiply by each other to make even more possibilities. Also, the first two of those three, crossing over first and then independent assortment, occur in meiosis. In other words, before there's even any reproduction. This is just when individuals are making their own gametes. And not only do they both occur, those first two, in meiosis, but more specifically in meiosis one. And so in 7, we're looking at a slide that looks very similar to a mitosis slide that we had in a previous chapter, except this is showing you what happens in meiosis instead of mitosis. And one major difference is that there's two splitting events, right, in meiosis. So the whole thing is split into the left side, which is meiosis 1, and then the right side, which is meiosis 2. But within meiosis 1 and within meiosis 2, you have subphases that have the same names as the subphases of mitosis. Different things are happening, though, compared to mitosis in those subphases. Prophase 1, you have to specify 1 for meiosis because it could be prophase of meiosis 1 or prophase of meiosis 2. Prophase 1, though, features something that you don't see happening at all in mitosis. Now, before we actually get into those details, though, this is obviously a cartoon cell representing some fictitious species. What is this species N? Why do you say so? Well, what is N? I mean, what does N mean? Not in this case. What is N in general?
The number of different kinds.
The number of different kinds of what? Feet?
No, of
chromosomes, yes. The number of different kinds of chromosomes. So does that make you more certain about your answer for what is N for this species?
Yes.
It is 3, yes. Remember that in a karyotype, the types are arranged by size, right? There's 3 sizes here, large, medium, and small. Okay, what's the ploidy of the cell entering meiosis here? Two is not an acceptable answer for what is the ploidy. Diploid, yes. Don't use a number for ploidy unless you use 2N. That would be acceptable. 2N is the diploid number in general, right? But use the word diploid or the word haploid to indicate the ploidy. Okay, so there's 2N total chromosomes here. N is 3, that means there's 6 overall, right? In prophase 1. For this diploid cell that's entering meiosis. But if this diploid cell were entering mitosis, it would still have those 6 chromosomes, right? 2 of each type. That's what makes it diploid. 2 number 1s, 2 number 2s, 2 number 3s. But in mitosis, a number 1 wouldn't care what the other number 1 is doing. They would all be acting independently. Each individual replicated chromosome would be acting independently. So you would have 2N different things in different positions, not caring what the others are doing. For mitosis. This is not mitosis. So a huge difference between prophase of mitosis and prophase 1 of meiosis is that in prophase 1, the two homologs of each type of chromosome find each other and come together. The two number 1s come together, the two number 2s come together, the two number 3s come together in this example because N is 3. For humans, there would be 23 different pairings, right? Because our N is 23. This coming together of chromosomes in prophase 1 of meiosis is called synapsis. Another use of the syn prefix meaning together, like in synthesis. Not only do homologs of each type synapse with its respective other homolog, but after this synapsis, there is crossing over, which is one of these three sources of extra variation that I talked about at the beginning of the lecture. That happens right away in prophase 1, crossing over. And you can see it here, but probably not from where you're seated. You can see the synapsis, I think, right? Each kind of chromosome is paired up here, one red and one blue. But what happens in crossing over is that, well, think about what you have as a homologous pair. What's another name for a homologous pair? When they're synapsed. A what? No, replicated describes each one individually. So the first number 1 is replicated. The second number 1 is also replicated. And they're homologous to each other and come together to form a tetrad. That's another name for a homologous pair. Tetrad meaning four-part thing because there are 4 overall chromatids, right? Since they're both replicated. So you have 2 blue sister chromatids identical to each other connected. That's 1 replicated chromosome. And that's 1 homolog. There's another homolog that's the other one of that same type of chromosome, the red version, also made up of 2 identical sister chromatids, identical to each other, right? But the chromatids in the red homolog are not identical to the chromatids in the blue one. And when they cross over, it is a physical crossing over of non-sister chromatids, one of the blue with one of the red. They're homologous, but they're not identical. And that occurs at a specific point along the length of the chromosome, that crossover point, which is called a chiasma. The plural is chiasmata. It just means cross. Same root as in chi, which is the Greek X, a cross. Okay, so not only do they cross over, these non-sister chromatids, one from each of the homologs, but after crossing over, they swap the segment after that crossover point with each other. And so here's what you can't really see on detail here, and you'll see it later, but I'll draw it here just so you understand it. So this red thing is one replicated homolog, right? A black one represents the other one, and they cross over at a certain point. These are non-sister chromatids crossing over, not identical to each other, because they came from different sources parentally. One of them came from the father of this person, this individual, one of them came from the mother of this individual. So they're not identical. So this is the chiasm, or chiasma, but they swap these sections after that point. And so what was an entirely red chromatid is now partially black, and what was a totally black one originally is now partially red. Now notice that just for this fact alone, right away you have brand new DNA sequence that has never existed. It's not like either original chromosome or the parents that it came from. Right? It's a brand new sequence that's never occurred in nature. Well, it is ridiculous how many ways that this can happen. Just for one homolog, just for one homologous pair, one tetrad, because it's not a specific place that has to be where the chiasma forms. It can be just about anywhere along the length. And the overall length is millions of nucleotides, right? One chromosome is millions of nucleotides long. And so think about how many different places where you can cross over. Each time you do that differently, you're making a different sequence of DNA. And this is why, just for this fact alone, this is why, even though using humans as an example, a male makes millions of sperm every day by meiosis. Starts with the same DNA originally, right? But by meiosis makes haploid sperm. And even though a male will make millions of sperm every day for 50 years or more, the chance that two of those sperm in his lifetime will be genetically identical is very close to zero. It's effectively zero. In fact, he could live a million years doing the same thing and still never make the same sperm twice. And that's because not only is this happening with a hell of a lot of possibilities just for this one tetrad, but then you have to raise that enormous number to the 23rd power for humans, because the same thing is happening on each of the other 22 homologous pairs. And when you make that estimate of how many possibilities there are just for crossing over alone, that number is already much bigger than the number of atoms than there are in the universe.
Come on now.
I'm serious.
I'm tired.
It is ridiculously huge.
Meanwhile,
the other prospective parent making her gametes has just as many possibilities for her eggs. Okay, that's just for crossing over. Effectively infinite, really. Which is why you are never going to have the same offspring, genetically speaking, more than once. Okay, but that's not the only source of variation. That's just enough as it is. That happens in prophase 1. The rest of prophase 1, pretty similar. You have the spindle becoming more and more polarized, just like you do in mitosis. Okay, metaphase. That's the lining up phase, right, for both mitosis and meiosis. But here's where it's really important for you to appreciate what's different about what is lining up in the two. So let's pause with meiosis and just imagine mitosis again. What lines up during metaphase of mitosis? Not individually. The replicated chromosomes, each of which is made up of two sister chromatids, right? But individual replicated chromosomes. We don't, in mitosis, even use the word homologs. Because the one number one doesn't give a fuck what the other number one is doing. Right? They don't synapse. So, in general, how many things are lining up in mitosis in a diploid cell? Two N. Because the two number ones don't care what each other is doing, right? So for this species, if this were mitosis instead, there would be six things lining up. 2N. 2 times 3 is 6. You wouldn't have the two number ones together. You would have a 1 and another 1 somewhere else. You'd have a 2 and another 2 somewhere else, and so on, right? Well, that's not what lines up in meiosis. Instead, in metaphase 1, I should say, meiosis 1, what lines up are tetrads. In other words, homologous pairs of replicated chromosomes. Two number ones as a unit, the two number twos as a unit, the two number threes as a unit. So there are N things lining up in a diploid cell instead of 2N things. Is that clear? Well, that brings us to the second major source of extra genetic variation, which I said was independent assortment, right? You already have a ridiculous number of possibilities because of crossing over, but it's going to get even bigger now. The assortment word of the phrase independent assortment refers to how an individual tetrad, which is one pair of homologous chromosomes, lines up. Now, if you think about an individual replicated chromosome in mitosis lining up, there's only one way, because the two chromatids are identical, right? This makes no difference, flipping it. But for a tetrad, which is one blue and one red, it does matter. It has two ways that it can line up. The poles here are up and down in this cartoon. So it can line up with red up and blue down, or blue up and red down. That matters because red and blue are not identical to each other, right? But that's what assortment by itself is, how it lines up, which is kind of like a flip of a coin for each tetrad. Yeah?
For the replicated chromosome, are you saying it was up, one up and one down? Like if it was like this, right?
I didn't say unreplicated. For a replicated chromosome by itself, not a homologous pair.
Right, so it's a homologous pair lined up like this, and there's another one down here.
Well, yes, if it's a homologous pair, yes. But both of them are replicated. So this is one replicated chromosome. This is the other.
Oh, okay.
That's a homologous pair. But in what I was saying is that in mitosis, you would have just this lining up, and somewhere else you would have this lining up, and this doesn't matter which one's on the top or bottom, they're identical.
Okay.
But this, it matters, because black is not identical to red.
Does it matter if it's flipped the other way, vertically? Like, the bottom one, if it's flipped like this, instead of like this?
No, because they're not going to go this way to the side. They're going to go to the, in this case, but I'm using this example where the poles are top and bottom. This is the metaphase plate. So this is the way that it matters, not this way. Okay, so That's assortment by itself. How one pair of chromosomes, of homologs, lines up. Independent assortment refers to the fact that how one tetrad lines up, blue up or blue down, is not at all dependent on how the other tetrads line up. They're all independent events. Each tetrad is acting by itself. So you don't have necessarily the case that all the reds will be up and all the blues will be down. That would be if they all acted the same, if they were dependent on each other, right? Instead, you have independent assortment. So if they're going to end up all red up and all blue down, that's just by chance. Here what you see is happening is two of them were red up, blue down. One of them was blue up and red down. Because each one was independently, randomly choosing a head or a tail in the coin flip analogy. Does that all make sense? Okay, well, I'll talk more about how many possibilities there are a little later. But that, there's a number of possibilities that depends on N just for independent assortment. And that number, which can be pretty big, gets multiplied by the already almost infinite number of ways there are for crossing over. So it gets even more. That's just for one parent, and the same thing in the other parent. Now, if you're comfortable with realizing the difference between what lines up in meiosis one and what lines up in mitosis, then it should be easy to realize that what separates in anaphase one is different from what separates in anaphase of mitosis, because different things lined up just earlier. So in mitosis, remember, what separates in anaphase are the sister chromatids making up each individual replicated chromosome. And notice that that does not change the ploidy, because you're just calling a replicated chromosome one chromosome before. Now you have two former chromatids that are individual chromosomes now, but they're going to go to one cell or the other. So the two cells are both going to get the same number of chromosomes as the original cell had. They're just not going to be replicated anymore. The ploidy does not change. You see that? But since what lines up in meiosis one are tetrads and not individual replicated chromosomes, what separates in anaphase one are homologs from each other, not chromatids from each other. And each cell is therefore, each cell that will become when it splits, is going to receive just one homolog. The other cell is going to receive the other homolog. That is where the ploidy gets reduced in half. Once these cells are produced after the splitting, each of those is already going to be haploid, because each one of them already has only one of each type of chromosome. They have one homolog, not both anymore. And in fact, we stop using the word homologous once again, because that only makes sense when they're both in the same cell. Now they're in separate cells. So that's meiosis one, is where the ploidy reduction takes place. And that's the goal of meiosis, remember. That's the reason it has to exist. So that it will undo the doubling of the ploidy that fertilization causes, to prevent a generation-to-generation buildup. A doubling every generation would kill the species. So the goal has been met, but you have a problem still, because these two already haploid cells still have replicated chromosomes, which is enough DNA for two cells each. Right? And that's why you need to go through meiosis two, which is just like mitosis, in which what lines up are individual replicated chromosomes. Now, because of the things that happened in meiosis one, the crossing over, these are no longer identical sister chromatids. They're still called sister chromatids because they're stuck together, but they're no longer identical to each other because of the crossing over. That's why a bit of this is blue here. But other than that, it's the same as mitosis. It's individual replicated chromosomes lining up, and then sister chromatids splitting in anaphase. That's happening for each of the two cells that are created in the first meiosis division. And therefore, by the time you get done with it all, you have four overall cells for each cell that entered the process. All four of those are haploid, because the ploidy has been cut in half from diploid to haploid. And all four of them are genetically different from each other because of crossing over and independent assortment. And much more than them being different from each other, because there's only four of them, what I was saying before is that these numbers are so enormous that every time that same parent undergoes meiosis, four are going to be produced, and those four are going to be different from all the other batches of four that he will ever make in his lifetime, or in many, many lifetimes if he had the chance. Okay, so all the gametes for an individual's entire lifetime are different, not just these four. Okay, that's the basics of meiosis. Whoops. Eight is a chart that compares mitosis with meiosis. So we've been doing this all along, really. It's not that there's new information here, but it's good to look at these pictures again. Or to look at these pictures to begin with. Mitosis does not change the ploidy. All it does is produce two cells of the same ploidy that you start with. In other words, it's a copying mechanism. It makes two genetically identical cells, genetically identical to each other and genetically identical to the cell you started with. So it makes sense to say that a haploid cell enters mitosis. That's perfectly possible. That's how a fungus grows up, right? It starts as a zygote and then immediately... that's how we become multicellular. For a fungus, though, it starts out as a spore, which is haploid, produced by meiosis, and then through mitosis becomes multicellular haploid. The fact that mitosis does not change ploidy is why it doesn't matter what the ploidy is of the original cell. It can undergo mitosis to become two of that same ploidy again. But it doesn't make sense to think of a haploid cell entering meiosis, because a haploid cell only has one of each, by definition, kind of chromosome, and it can't get reduced into half. Right? You can't have a ploidy, you can't have half of each type. But since this is a head-to-head comparison and the meiosis cell is diploid to begin with, we're looking at a mitosis cell that starts out as diploid. What is the N here for mitosis?
Three.
What about for the meiosis side? Three. It's the same species, just two different processes. There's three kinds of chromosomes. But notice that what's lining up in the mitosis metaphase is 2N things, 2N individual replicated chromosomes. Whereas what lines up in meiosis 1 are N things, N tetrads. Right? Okay. There's only one division event in mitosis, and that's going to split apart chromatids that are identical. And the ploidy doesn't change because one cell is going to get one of each of these 2N chromatids that are now chromosomes in their own right, and the other one's going to get the same number. It started diploid. Both of these are diploid. They're genetically identical to each other and to the original cell. But what splits apart in meiosis one are not sister chromatids, it's homologs separate from each other, splitting up the tetrad. One cell is going to get the mostly red, the other one's going to get the mostly blue version for each tetrad. And how they assorted depends on how many mostly blue you get and how many mostly red you get. Well, that still leaves two cells that are already haploid but still replicated. So you have to have meiosis two to split the sister chromatids, resulting in four final cells, those are the gametes, haploid, genetically distinct. Nine is yet another summary, but in words. And I've already said this stuff to you, so I'm not going to read this to you, but it's a good thing to study, to make the comparisons. All right, that just leaves a couple slides in this chapter, and unfortunately they're in the reverse order that they really should be, because what we see here is a treatment of independent assortment, which actually occurs after crossing over, but we're looking at independent assortment first. Now, if you have an N of one species, just one type of chromosome, right? And it's diploid, entering meiosis, has to be diploid to enter meiosis. There's not really any, there's only one possible way that it can assort. Yes, it can be, just imagine only one of these. Yes, it can be blue on the left and red on the right, or red on the left and blue on the right, but that's not really a difference. Because either way, one cell is going to get the blue one, one cell is going to get the red one. There's no difference, right? You see that? You sure? Okay. But if you have an N of two, then there are two possibilities now. And you can see them here. One possibility is that one cell gets both blue and the other one gets both red because of how they assorted or lined up. And the other possibility is that one of them gets a blue and a red. Right? So that's for an N of two. There's two possibilities. Two is equal to two to the first power. If you had an N of three, then for each of these two possibilities, you would have two possibilities depending on how that third one lined up. Right? So you'd have a total of 2 times 2, or 4, which is 2 squared possibilities, right? For an N of 3. And in general, the total number of possible ways that you can have independent assortment line things up is 2 raised to the N minus 1 power. It doubles every time you add another kind of chromosome. Every time N gets bigger by 1. So for humans, N is 23, and therefore this has nothing to do with crossing over. Just the number of ways in which they can line up with red and blue one way or the other for humans is 2 raised to the 22nd power, which is over 4 million, which kind of seems like a big number, and it is. But 4 million is practically zero compared to the number of ways you already had of crossing over before you even get to that. It's just that the crossing over number is roughly 10 to the 120th power. The total number of atoms in the universe is about 10 to the 80th power.
How do you know?
Because you can make estimates based on how massive things are and how massive atoms are. So that's 10 to the 120th is much bigger than 10 to the 80th. That's the number of crossover possibilities. And then you have to multiply that by the number of independent assortment possibilities. So you multiply that by 4 million. That makes it even more ridiculous. And that really kind of represents a deck of cards. I mean, you can think of it as a deck of cards for one parent. a deck of cards with 10 to the 130th power, practically, number of cards in it that you pick one from. That means you take one gamete from that individual. It can make that many, so you're picking from that huge deck, right? And you're picking one card from the other parent to get that gamete, also the same size deck. And therefore, the number of possible zygotes, which is choosing one card from each deck, is the size of the deck times the size of the deck, which makes it like the 250th power. Yes, it is. It's that's why it's effectively infinite. It's not truly infinite, of course, but anyway, that's what random fertilization is. The third source of genetic variation is that you're, even if you're using the same two parents over and over, you're using totally different gametes each time from each parent.
What about twins?
Well, there's two types of twins. There's fraternal twins, which is really just simultaneously being pregnant with two different zygotes. Two eggs get fertilized by two different sperm. It just happens at the same time, which is how it happens in a lot of organisms that have more than one offspring at a time, right? A litter is fraternal twins. And they're genetically different from each other, just like brothers and sisters born at different times or siblings born at different times are genetically different. But there are genetically identical twins. That's just an accident, though. That started out as one zygote intended to be one human, and because of an accidental splitting of that cell, this body treated that as two individual zygotes to start out again. But they're genetically identical from each other because they came from the same cell. But for you to have identical offspring just for the randomness, you'd have to live a long time for that to happen, or get very lucky. Okay, so but anyway, that's independent assortment. That actually occurs after slide 11, though, because that occurs at independent assortment, since it involves assortment, it happens at metaphase. That's what determines it, right? Slide 11 is about crossing over, though, and that happens in prophase 1. And so it's really just what I drew already, but you see a cartoon version of it. Non-sister chromatids. And by the way, it's even probably bigger than what I've estimated, because there's nothing saying you only cross over once. There can be two crossover points, which makes it even more ridiculously big. But there's a swapping of non-sister chromatid material at each chiasm, and that's why you end up having non-identical gametes. That is the chapter.